Hello and welcome to the Race and Rights Podcast. This is Sahar Aziz, distinguished law professor at Rutgers Law School, author of the book, The Racial Muslim, When Racism Quashes Religious Freedom, and director of the Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights, also known as CSRR. You can learn more about the center by visiting our website at csrr.rutgers.edu or following us on Instagram at RutgersCSRR or on Twitter and Facebook at RUCSRR. The Race and Rights Podcast explores the myriad issues that adversely impact the civil and human rights of America's diverse Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities, here as well as abroad. Today's episode is entitled The 100 Years War on Palestine, featuring historian and Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi, who will discuss his book by the same name. Professor Khalidi explains the origins and consequences of 100 years of colonial war on the Palestinians, waged first by the Zionist movement and then by Israel, but backed by Britain and the United States, the great powers of the age. Let's hear what our guest has to say about the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and America's role in preventing it from coming to fruition.
Welcome, Professor Khalidi, to the virtual event hosted by CSRR and Dawn. So I'd like to start, before we delve into the history, and you are one of the most renowned historians of Palestine, I want to start the conversation by running through the events of the past 4 weeks to explain how we got to where we are today.
First of all, thank you for having me, Sahar. Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to all who made this event possible, and thanks to everybody who's participating virtually. We're getting used to this weird way of communicating. Certainly I am. I think we're going to be delving into the historical background in a bit through some of your questions. But I think it is actually useful to talk about the events of the past several weeks before this, the extreme violence of the Israeli attacks on Gaza and rocket fire from Gaza into Israel began. Because in the way in which this is usually narrated, and it's an Israeli favored way of doing it, there are sort of perpetual beginnings which start with the first rocket. And that's not where things started. It's not where things start in Gaza. Gaza has been subjected to a siege since 2007. The population of Gaza have basically been imprisoned. Their access to the world has been cut off, and they have been subjected to an incredible blockade as far as all kinds of materials are concerned, from medicine and food to building materials, books, and so forth. That is not irrelevant to what is happening today, nor in fact, it's one of the major reasons that what is happening today is happening. That siege and that blockade, by the way, began before the first rocket was ever fired from Gaza. So the blockade and siege are not a result of something. This is what I mean about perpetual beginnings. Israel loves to start by talking about a rocket was fired from Gaza. And in fact, we may talk about the indiscriminate fire of rockets from Gaza as a potential war crime, which it probably very likely is. But to understand that in context is absolutely important. So are things like proportionality and the indiscriminate nature of attacks on civilians. But to go to your question, which is, how did we get to where we got in the last week or 10 days? Well, we got there via a series of practices which are not new. Practices of eviction of people from their homes, dispossession of families. In Sheikh Jarrah, for example, which is just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of this happening all over Palestine, over many, many decades. In the case of Sheikh Jarrah, the people being dispossessed from a number of families were dispossessed on the basis of property claims by Israeli settler organizations to property in East Jerusalem. These were families which, in fact, had been dispossessed from their homes in Jaffa and Haifa in 1948. They were not entitled to make claims for their property, which is now inside Israel, whereas these settler groups were being backed by the might of the Israeli state in implementing their claims. So we're talking here about something that takes us actually back to the core of the Palestine problem, which is the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from what is now Israel 73 years ago, and their dispossession, not just of their homeland, but of their property. And so for all Palestinians and for people throughout the Arab world, people who know this background, what happens in Sheikh Jarrah, what has been happening in other neighborhoods like Silwan, around Jerusalem, what happens in other parts of the occupied West Bank is something that touches on a traumatic series of events that goes back more than three generations. Similarly, the assaults on the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli security forces. And I have to stress, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was built in the 7th century, in the 680s. It is one of the oldest, perhaps the oldest mosque in the world. It is the third holiest place in Islam. It's the first direction of prayer for Muslims. It's the third holiest place. Ula al-Qiblatayn, Thalith al-Haramayn in Arabic. Israeli forces on a Ramadan night when worshippers were praying entered the plaza around the mosque, the Haram al-Sharif, the esplanade around the mosque, fired tear gas, and then fired tear gas and stun grenades into the mosque itself while people were worshiping. Imagine this happening in St. Peter's Basilica on Easter. Imagine it happening in any synagogue anywhere in the world on the High Holy Days or on any important Jewish religious occasion. This was done, and those assaults on the mosque went on night after night. They reached a paroxysm 10 days ago. And this is not the first time that this has happened. And so again, it was something that naturally offended and angered people, not just in Palestine, not just in Jerusalem, not just in Palestine, but all over the Muslim world. And it was one of a series of events which in effect triggered off the high-level military attacks from Gaza into Israel, and then much more intensively by Israel into Gaza.
Thank you for giving us that summary of what's been going on, as you said, for decades. And unfortunately, those of us in the U.S. only see it covered in the news media when hundreds, at this point, I think we've reached 227, if not more, Gazans, the vast majority of them are civilians, are killed and almost reaching 2,000 wounded. So it's unfortunate this is the only time that we hear about these events that have been going on for decades, or these human rights violations. So let's step back and talk about the history, which you have your book is fabulous. I can't over promote it enough because of the level of detail in your book. In this book, The 100 Years of War in Palestine, but also your previous books. But can you tell us the historical backdrop of evictions, home demolitions, checkpoints, roads that are only for the Jewish settlers and not permitted to be used by Palestinians who are occupied in the West Bank? But can you tell us this historical backdrop of what appears to be ethnic cleansing that allows us to understand these evictions of Palestinians from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah and in East Jerusalem?
Well, I mean, there are levels of background and background. The ongoing process of colonization of the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem has been going on since 1967. The objective, using a term that the Israeli government uses, is to Judaize what is seen as part of the historic land of Israel. It is to create a reality that is unchangeable, such that Israel has taken control of and, in effect, annexed the entirety of the land between the Jordan River and the sea. That's the process that's been going on since 1967, since the occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. This process of colonization, however, did not begin in 1967. And the attendant theft of private and state land, the attendant dispossession of Palestinian owners of that land did not begin in 1967. This is a process that is inherent in something that started with the birth of modern political Zionism, which was the attempt to create, as a refuge for Jewish refugees from European persecution, a Jewish state in a land which, when Theodor Herzl wrote a book of that title, The Jewish State, in 1896, had an overwhelming Arab majority. In other words, Zionism attempted, for reasons that had to do with persecution of Jews in Europe, to create a Jewish majority state with sovereignty and control over immigration in an Arab-majority country. That necessitated the expulsion or the removal of as much as possible of the population. That is why we had ethnic cleansing in 1948. It was not a result of the fighting. It was a result of the overwhelming need, as seen by Zionists, to create a Jewish majority in a country in which, in 1947, when the United Nations passed its partition resolution, giving most of the country, handing most of the country over to be turned into a Jewish state, had a 65% Arab majority. You can't create a Jewish majority state in most of a country with a large Arab majority. And that's the basic. And that's basically why the families being evicted from their homes, or which it was projected would be evicted from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, were not being evicted for the first time, would not have been evicted for the first time. They had already been evicted from homes in Haifa and in Jaffa back in 1948. They had already lost their property, and they were about to be evicted once again. So for Palestinians and for anybody, frankly, anybody who's concerned with principles of justice and equality and human rights for all, what we're talking about is a systematic legal discrimination. There are rights that are enjoyed by one group that are not enjoyed by another group. There are property rights, there are human rights, there are political rights. And that's the situation in Palestine today. Some people enjoy full political rights, mainly Israeli Jews. Some enjoy limited political rights because of discriminatory laws passed by the Israeli state, Palestinians who live as citizens of the state of Israel. And some, 5 million Palestinians living under occupation for 53 years, the temporary occupation that's lasted for 53 years, basically have no rights. They have no political rights over the only authority that controls everything important between the river and the sea, which is the Israeli state. So that is, I think, very quickly the background to what we were seeing in Sheikh Jarrah and what we've been seeing in the occupied territories for several decades now in terms of dispossession and eviction and either land theft or recuperation of rights, which is allowed for Israelis, but is not allowed for Palestinians.
Thank you. And I know we can't do justice to the depth of history, but I did want to kind of highlight something you talked about in your book, where you identified four key groups, right, that shape the fate of Palestinians, that have shaped the fate of Palestinians since the 1917 Balfour Declaration by Britain. The first is the Western powers, used to be called the Great Powers. First, it was Britain and then the United States currently. Second, the Palestinians themselves and their various organizations and their various disagreements among the organizations, Arab states, and then Israel. I think it's important because we have different levels of knowledge in the audience, and I think it's important to at least identify or provide an abbreviated historical backdrop of the role of Britain between 1917 and 1947, you know, right before the 1948 war in which Israel established itself and was recognized at that point by the United States, and then other countries followed suit. So can you tell us the key decisions or actions by the British that would seal the fate of the Palestinians as a stateless people until the present day, and why the British took these actions?
Well, this is actually an important question because this is not just a conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. It's not just a struggle. In fact, it's not only a struggle between, you know, two national movements or two peoples. It is and has always been an effort to which the great powers were absolutely essential. Without Britain, Israel could not have been established as it was established. Without the United States and the Soviet Union in the 1940s, Israel could not have been established as it was established. And in the period since then, external powers, mainly the United States, have been absolutely essential to the maintenance of a status quo which has seen Israel expand and grow stronger and stronger at the expense of the Palestinians. As far as Britain is concerned, by issuing the Balfour Declaration on November 2nd, 1917, what the British government did was, in my view, to declare war on the Palestinian people. The Palestinians at that stage were 95% of the population. The Balfour Declaration stated that the British government looked with favor on the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being understood that nothing would be done to harm the civil and religious rights of the non-Jewish communities there. This said, there is one people in Palestine with national and political rights, and there's not another people. And the other riffraff, not named, not Palestinians, not Arabs, they were just non-Jewish communities, had civil and religious rights. What did that mean? It meant they were not a nation. They were not entitled to self-determination. They had civil and religious rights, but they did not have political rights. Britain implemented the Balfour Declaration through a League of Nations mandate So we're not just talking about Britain, we're talking about the international community in the form of the League of Nations, implementing what in effect was the dispossession of the Palestinians, a declaration that the Palestinians are not a people and do not have rights of national self-determination, even though the covenant of the League of Nations said that they should have it, they and other peoples in the former Ottoman Empire should have it. And this is the drive that enabled the Zionist movement to establish what in effect was a para-state. The mandate enabled them to create an elected assembly, enabled them to create organs of self-government, enabled them to have support for settlement on the land, for creating infrastructure, for land purchase, for unlimited immigration. In 1 year, in 1935, there were 60,000 Jewish immigrants to Palestine. Now, this was at the height of Hitler's persecution of the Jews. Palestine was a refuge. That was the same number of Jews that lived in Palestine in 1917. In 1 year, as many people arrived, as many Jewish immigrants arrived as the entire Jewish population of the country in 1917. Understandably, the Palestinians were not thrilled about the idea that they had no national rights, that their country, in which they were the overwhelming majority, was not entitled to self-determination, and that another group was being supported by the international community and by Britain in this effort. So this is the beginning of what I call the war on Palestine. This is not just a conflict between Zionists and Arabs, or later on Israelis and Palestinians. This is a conflict in which Britain, for its own strategic reasons that had nothing to do with Zionism and that go way back before the Balfour Declaration, decided it needed to control Palestine and that it needed to do this, it decided to do this through its support for the Zionist movement.
Okay, yeah, there's a lot more to it. So I know we don't have enough time. No, I understand. Again, I'm just going to show this book because this is really a great, it's very readable, notwithstanding the extent of detail that you include. So those of you who want more, please read the book. Let's talk about the United States, which is what most of our audience is. It's where they currently reside. It's where we all, you and I and Sarah and those of us who are hosting this reside. And this is a democracy. And we're seeing some shifts in public opinion as evinced by the massive turnout in protests across this country, also in other parts of the world. And yet, that sentiment that is at the grassroots level is not necessarily reflected in Congress, in the White House, and in formal halls of power, right? Although the polls still show, and I think there was a poll, it was in March, before the war on Gaza right now, before the current war, and killing, the Israeli military killing civilians disproportionately, potentially in violation, I'll be charitable and say potentially in violation of international law, although I think a lot of other lawyers would say the evidence is pretty clear. When you bomb entire buildings that are 13 stories high and include international media among civilians, that in any other country or any other context, there would be international outcry and there would be no question whether this was a violation of the law of war in terms of targeting civilians and disproportionality. So there are questions. What are the domestic factors and the international factors that are affecting the official U.S. position on Palestine and what seems to be an unquestioning support for Israel? It's not so much the critique isn't so much that the U.S. supports Israel, it's that doesn't seem to be any kind of critical analysis, any type of considering both sides, considering human rights and taking them seriously of Palestinians. But you hear these platitudes and these statements that say Israel has a right to defend itself, full stop, as if the Palestinians don't exist and their rights don't exist, and that there's no question as to what the facts on the ground are beyond kind of this generic statement. So in your expertise, what do you think are those domestic and international factors that are producing the formal U.S. position and policies?
I think that as with Britain, there are both strategic and domestic reasons for the United States' support for Israel, as with Britain's support of the Zionist project before World War II. The strategic reasons have changed over time. During the Cold War, for example, Israel was seen as a valuable ally or proxy against the Soviet Union. Since the so-called War on Terror was launched by George W. Bush, Israel has enlisted itself as an ally, including its own enemies in the American target list, among them groups that have never done anything to the United States per se. And it is therefore seen as a strategic, has been seen for different periods and in different ways as a strategic asset for the United States. Nobody ever looks at the other side of the balance sheet, the opprobrium that accrues to the United States for what is seen as its unbalanced support of Israel and its violation of Palestinian human rights. People systematically engaged in poo-pooing this. The Arabs don't care about Palestine and we don't care about the Arabs. But I think this goes to this issue of democracy. We're not talking about the Arab peoples. We're talking about unrepresentative, undemocratic, autocratic Arab regimes which ignore the wishes of their people and which in some cases are propped up by the United States in order to suppress their peoples. I'm talking about the regimes of the Gulf, for example. I'm talking about the regime of Egypt, for example. I'm talking about various other regimes in the Arab world, which in fact is a black hole globally where democracy is concerned. So it's not the Arabs who don't care. It's the regimes dependent on external support and devoid in many cases of any legitimacy that don't care. People in the Arab world do care. And so there is a cost, but this is never calculated by American policymakers. They talk about the governments that they deal with and they talk about the strategic advantages. They don't talk about the strategic disadvantages. Look at polling in the Arab world about what people think about Palestine, Israel, about what people think about the United States. And you'll see that there is a cost, a severe cost to the United States over decades for this policy. The other aspect of American support for Israel, some people have reduced it to the idea of an Israel lobby. I think that's overly simplistic. I mean, the AIPAC and other elements of the lobby are clearly important as far as the legislature is concerned and as far as lobbying the administration is concerned. But I think we have to go to another level, a cultural level. A wonderful book by Amy Kaplan called Our American Israel. She was a Leah Hamha, may she rest in peace. She was a brilliant cultural historian, and she talked about the cultural basis of American support for Israel. And this is a function of a successfully developed narrative over many generations, starting with the rise of modern political Zionism, rooted in the biblical narrative, dear to the hearts of American Christians and Jews, obviously, and which has been woven into a nationalist narrative, the Zionist narrative, in an enormously successful way, such that for this and many other reasons, there is and has been widespread support for Israel among people who, whether for biblical reasons or for other cultural reasons, feel sympathetic. Israel describes itself as a nation of settlers and pioneers, a nation of immigrants. The implication of settlers and pioneers is that they're holding off a hostile environment of natives. And that is how Americans, many of them at least, see American history. Americans held off hostile natives. So a lot of tropes in the Israeli narrative register with and resonate with tropes in the American national narrative. We're proud of the colonial period of American history. Israel had a colonial period too in its own historiography. One of the major institutions that was involved in acquiring land in Palestine was called, by the Zionists themselves, the Jewish Colonization Agency. This is not some anti-Semitic smear by a bunch of fanatical Arabs. This is what they called themselves. So for these and many other reasons, there's deep sympathy for Israel. Only democracy in the Middle East. Actually, not true. Lebanon's a democracy, dysfunctional, corrupt, but a democracy. Kuwait is a democracy. Many, many limitations on it. Israel has ruled for 53 years over a population almost as large as its own population, which has no rights. If that's a democracy, then the Jim Crow South was a democracy, and the slaveholding South was a democracy. You had a huge population with no rights in both cases. They're not the same, obviously. Palestinians in the occupied territories are not slaves, and they're not living in the same situation of segregation and deprivation of rights as people in the Jim Crow South were. But they are similar, and to call them democracies is a travesty, frankly. But those tropes have resonance, and they're repeated endlessly by politicians. They're repeated endlessly by the media, as are other tropes. The United States is engaged in a war on terror. Israel has succeeded in painting Palestinian resistance as terror. Killing 2,200 civilians in Gaza in 2014 is not terror. Killing a dozen Israeli civilians is terror in 2014. Today, Hamas fires rockets indiscriminately, probably in violation of the rules of law, and has killed, at last count, I think about 12 Israeli civilians. Israel has killed over 220 people in the Gaza Strip, most of them civilians. That's not terrorism. it's good. It shot down 20-odd Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. That's not terrorism. No Israeli, as far as we know, has been killed in the occupied territories. So coding a certain form of violence by an occupied people, by a people that's been dispossessed as terrorism, and coding the violence done by one of the great regional superpowers, nuclear armed, with the by far the best air force, not only in the Middle East, perhaps one of the best air forces in the world, and the most high-tech defense industry, perhaps on Earth outside the United States, that's not terrorism. So those kinds of elements of a very carefully crafted narrative are among the many, many reasons why Israel enjoys as much support, has enjoyed in the past, as much support as it has. I think a lot of this is crumbling with younger people. It's crumbling in sectors of the Jewish community. It's crumbling among many groups that see their own struggles within the United States, and blacks, Native Americans, Latinx populations, and many others. What's happening in Palestine is not the same as what's happening in Ferguson or what's happening in Minneapolis or what's happening at Standing Rock, but people see that there are connections. At least they understand things that destroy this mythical veil of a narrative which entirely reflects an Israeli point of view. That, in other words, I think is beginning to change.
Right. And I just want to build on what you just said on the domestic side, because as someone who focuses more on the domestic civil rights context, there are terms that are becoming more acceptable and mainstreamed, and I think from many academics' perspectives are more accurate, which are things like settler colonialism or a settler society, which the United States is. It's a fact. What we did to the Native Americans, or what people who settled from England did to the Native Americans, is documented. Similarly, systemic racism, right? And also recognizing that the attack on voting rights through gerrymandering and through impositions of, or making voting less accessible, right? And less easy through opposition to mail-in ballots. All of these attacks on civil rights that tend to either intentionally or purposely target minorities, or at least disparately impact them, people are finally recognizing, especially the young generation. And once they see that and see the world through that lens, then suddenly things in Israel and Palestine start to make more sense, as opposed to having this very Pollyannish idealistic view that is based in large part on state propaganda by people who are in power. And so, again, I think what's important for all of us is to identify the biases in mainstream media and try to get those facts from the people who are actually experiencing the situation, rather than those who have power and have self-interest in hiding inconvenient facts and also portraying themselves as victims or heroes when, in fact, they may be the perpetrators of violence. So that gets me to the Palestinians. And one of the myths about Palestinians that tends to percolate in the American mainstream media and in American culture, one is that Palestinians don't want peace. And second is that Palestinians never miss an opportunity to obtain peace or to seek peace. And there's also a homogenization, which in itself I think is racist, to assume an entire group of people all agree and that one group represents all of them is in itself a racist concept, because as we know, for example, in the United States, when one white Christian commits an act of terror, nobody then presumes that white Christians should be suspected of being potential terrorists. We identify and acknowledge, rightfully so, this is one individual who acted. And even if they are associated with others, it's just those individuals. So the concept of individual opportunity as opposed to collective punishment or guilt by association. So that brings me to the Palestinian, you know, the internal Palestinian politics. And the Palestinians are people with a national identity tied to a distinct culture and a specific geography. They are a real people. Another myth that Palestine was a land without a people, that has clearly been debunked, where their families have lived for centuries. Like any other communities, they are diverse on multiple grounds. So can you tell us more about the origins and the rise of Hamas, because there's a lot of talk about Hamas, and this is in some way a diversionary tactic to just focus on this one group within a very complicated ecosystem of political groups that go back all the way at least to 1917, but most certainly 1948. The backdrop of the key players in Palestinian politics post 1948 and what factors have contributed to political fragmentation among Palestinians?
And that's a huge question, Sahar. I'll try and answer bits and pieces of it. I think it's important what you mentioned at the very beginning, this idea that the Palestinians don't exist, they're not a real people. There's one of the questions in the Q&A saying the Palestinians came and settled. Aren't they, you know, outsiders, interlopers? My family is documented as having lived in Jerusalem since at least the 13th or 14th century. There's some possibility that it goes back before the Crusades. Most Palestinian villages have been there. We can see this from Ottoman records going back to the 15th and 16th century, especially for a very large number. They've been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, the villages and the villagers and the family names. So this myth of the Palestinians aren't a people and they're not the indigenous population is basically the settler colonial mantra that all newcoming settler colonial projects have to spin in order to justify their indigeneity at the expense of the indigenous native population. The Palestinians came to national consciousness at about the same time as most peoples in the world came to national consciousness. There were people living there. It was called Palestine in Arabic, but did they think of themselves as Palestinians? As I showed in a book that I published many years ago, like most other peoples in the Arab world and like the modern political Zionism, it's a late 19th century phenomenon and early 20th century phenomenon. And Palestinian nationalism has developed in a variety of ways ever since then. It has had failures. It has suffered from poor leadership in periods like the Mandate period, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. It suffered from almost eclipse after the 1948 war and what Palestinians call the Nakba. They call the catastrophe that led to the dissolution of Palestinian society, the destruction of much of Palestinian society after Israel expelled 750,000 Palestinians from what is today Israel. But it has also enjoyed some periods when there are some kinds of effective Palestinian leadership. Today, the Palestinians are, in my view, are at a low point. They're physically divided between different parts of former mandatory Palestine. The West Bank is isolated from Jerusalem. The Gaza Strip is isolated from the world. Palestinians inside Israel have separate status. And about half of the Palestinian people live outside of Palestine. They're the descendants of people who were driven out in 1948 or were expelled or forced to leave thereafter. Although I have to say, one of the things that has appeared in the last few weeks is a resurgence of Palestinian unity throughout the Palestinian people, whether the diaspora, whether the occupied territories, or whether inside Israel. Their national movement, however, is at a low ebb because of both these physical divisions and also because of political divisions, as between the dominant faction in the West Bank, which is Fatah, and the dominant faction in the Gaza Strip, which is Hamas. You've asked me to talk about Hamas. You know, there are books and books and books on the subject. I cannot do justice to Hamas in 3 minutes, which I will nevertheless try and do. Hamas was established in 1987. It was an outgrowth of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which started in Egypt in 1928. When it was first established, and in the years leading up to its foundation, it was the favored stepchild of the Israeli military occupation. Hamas, after its creation, and in its earlier incarnation as the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is attested by a number of Israeli sources, was the chosen weapon to weaken the Palestinian national movement by creating a rival to the PLO. It soon got out of control. It soon developed on its own. But it's important to understand that the division of the Palestinians, like the division of any subjugated people, is a prime objective of the colonizer. The British did this in India. American settlers did this with Native American nations in the United States. Every colonizer, the British did this in Ireland. Every colonizer does this. It's the playbook. Divide and rule. Julius Caesar. Gaul. I mean, I could go on and on. So a Palestinian division is a precondition for Israel achieving certain strategic objectives. And they've done fairly well, thanks, in my view, to the failures of Palestinian leadership, both Hamas and Fatah. Their inability to see beyond their narrow political benefit to the larger benefit of the Palestinian people as a whole. Hamas came to power in Gaza as a result not of seizing power militarily, but as a result of an election in 2006, when, with the support of the United States and the EU and the assent of the Israeli government at the time, an election was held in the entirety of the occupied territories, including occupied Arab East Jerusalem. And Hamas won. They won a plurality of the vote, which, given the nature of the electoral system, produced a majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council. So you had a president who had been elected representing Fatah, Mahmoud Abbas, the same person who's still there, even though his term ended more than a decade ago. And you had a Palestinian Legislative Council with a majority supporting Hamas. The United States, Israel, and the European countries, instead of trying to deal with an elected representative, decided that these people were terrorists, they could not be dealt with, and that Palestinian disunity and the absence of an interlocutor was better than having a unified Palestinian stand, which would have negotiated with Israel. Hamas said, we're going to let the PA negotiate with Israel. We accept the idea of a 100-year truce with Israel. These are facts that are elided from the discourse on Hamas. Hamas supports a two-state solution. I am an opponent of Hamas. I am not a Hamas advocate. I have serious quarrels with Hamas's social policies, with their politics. I think they've done a terrible job of running Gaza. I think they are as bankrupt as Fatah as far as strategic vision. I have no brook for Hamas. But the lies that are pumped out every time Hamas says, Hamas objects to the existence of... Well, Hamas, yes, has a position objecting to the state of Israel on a variety of grounds, but they support the idea of a negotiation towards a two-state solution and a long-term truce, as long as certain preconditions are met. There are a lot of people who don't know this, and the Israeli government doesn't want us to know this, because the Israeli government is run by people whose objective is to create, in the entirety of what they understand as the land of Israel, a single, unitary, Zionist state. Israel now controls the entirety of Palestine, and as far as they're concerned, that should be made permanent. And so for them, the idea of negotiating with people, whether Fatah, and the PA in Ramallah, or the boys in Gaza, is anathema. So for all of the things that I think it's done wrong, including the targeting of civilians indiscriminately, the weapons that Hamas uses are so inaccurate that they are necessarily indiscriminate. It's like falling off a rock to say that these are violations of international law. Israel is using weapons that it is capable of using discriminately and is killing civilians disproportionately. Those are also war crimes on a much larger scale. 2,200 in 2014 to a dozen civilians, 2,200, most of whom were civilians. So I would argue that Hamas has done, in my view, things that are fall into the category of war crimes. I have enormous critiques of it, but I think that the way in which Hamas has been demonized in the public record is quite similar to the way every colonial power demonizes every resistance movement that fights against it with means fair or foul. The IRA, before Ireland's independence, and in Northern Ireland, was demonized by the British. The ANC in South Africa was demonized by the apartheid regime. They didn't want to talk to them. They didn't like what they were doing, but the main objective was to put them beyond the pale. That's what the demonization of Hamas is about. The only reason Northern Ireland was settled, the only reason the British left Ireland in 1921, the Free State, was because the British finally broke down and sat down with them. The only reason South Africa is at peace today is because de Klerk and the apartheid regime finally agreed to sit down with the people that they'd spent decades demonizing as terrorists. I'll repeat it. I have many critiques of Hamas, but the demonization of Hamas is, in this case, a tool to avoid dealing with the basic realities. The basic realities are dispossession, refugee rights, Jerusalem, and equal rights for the Palestinians of national self-determination, like as the Israelis have enjoyed since 1948. And other human and civil and religious rights. Unless and until we have a solution that encompasses those rights for everybody, so that somebody doesn't have privileges just because of their ethnicity or religion, we're not going to be talking about a sustainable solution to this problem.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Race and Rights Podcast. This podcast is hosted by the Center for Security, Race, and Rights, housed at Rutgers Law School, also known as the People's Electric Law School. CSRR engages in research, education, and advocacy on issues that adversely impact the civil and human rights of America's diverse Muslim, Arab, and South Asian communities. We do so through an interfaith, cross-racial, and interdisciplinary approach. To hear additional episodes of the Race and Rights podcast, check out our pages on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and everywhere else podcasts are available. Now, for a deep dive on these issues, visit our website at csrr.rutgers.edu, where you can find policy reports, teach-ins, and news commentary by our over 130 faculty affiliates. To watch our over 80 academic and public policy lectures, subscribe to our YouTube channel at Rutgers Center for Security, Race, and Rights. And on social media, be sure to follow us on Instagram at RutgersCSRR and on Twitter and Facebook at RUCSRR. Finally, you can financially support the Center for Security, Race, and Rights by going to our website at csrr.rutgers.edu and press the donate button. And please give generously. As always, be well and see you next time.